10, 9, 8, 7, 6, 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Live from Nottingham, this is the News Hour with Tom Hopkins-Burke on Teachers Talk Radio.
Hey, me duck, it's Saturday, it's 1 p.m. and this is your News Hour with Tom Hopkins-Burke. In the next 60 minutes, we will cast a critical eye on the biggest education news stories over the last 7 days. With the news, give me your views, text in on the Podbean app or call in and make your voice heard. Tune in, talk it out, live on Podbean. This is Teachers Talk Radio.
Live from Nottingham, this is the News Hour with Tom Hopkins-Burke on Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live on the Podbean app or desktop player. Just head over to www.podbean.com/lsw/ttradio or search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio.
We are live and we are ready to go. Welcome to the Saturday News Hour on Teachers Talk Radio. My name is Tom Hopkins-Burke, and over the course of the next 60 minutes, we will be looking at the stories that have made the headlines on Teachers Talk Radio over the last 7 days. Today's show is a union conference special. Over the last week and a bit, the NASUWT and NEU teaching unions have held their annual conferences, this time virtually, as you would expect. We're going to go beyond the headlines and dive into the motions passed and not passed at each conference, analysing where the unions stand on exclusions, on terminal exams, on teachers' pay, on decolonising the curriculum, and more. We'll be asking what the unions stand for and whether they stand for you. We also want to hear from people who have considered joining or leaving the NEU or NASUWT in recent days and are exploring perhaps non-union forms of legal cover. If you have views about any of these issues, either in support or in opposition to the union stance, or if you are a member or a long-serving member of the NEU or NASUWT, you can press the call in button and tell us exactly how you feel. I'm always extremely keen to hear from you, whatever the subject, so please do tune in and talk it out. We have a special prize for the best caller today, so do keep on listening until the very end when I will be handing out a very special Teachers Talk Radio mug, because we are going to be flooding staff rooms across the UK with these. Everyone who calls in today to share their views, ask questions to our very special guests, or just to say hello, will have a chance to win this mug, and I will be awarding it at the end of the show, so make sure you do call in. Now, before we welcome on our guests today, and if you are listening, please do call in, it would be wrong of me not to pay tribute to one of our most entertaining and knowledgeable hosts, Matt Williams. Matt has hosted the Saturday Breakfast Show for the last 2 months, since the 6th of February. His shows have been bright, humorous, and also deeply personal. Matt stepped down this morning as one of our regular hosts. As regular listeners to his show will know, he has been fighting cancer. Recently, he received the news that the cancer has returned and is now at stage 4. I know how gutted Matt is about stepping down, and I know he is determined to defeat his prognosis and return at a later date as a guest host or hopefully as a regular again. If you haven't caught his show this morning, then do go and have a listen. Teachers Talk Radio founder Tom Rogers called in and said a few words of thanks. I think he may also have broken the record for live listeners at one time too, although I'm sure one of the exec team can verify that. Matt is a wonderful human being with a wonderful charm. He's been a great source of advice and comfort for new and emerging hosts on Teachers Talk Radio, and his shows have been the perfect way to start the weekend. Matt, you're always welcome to come on to my show or any other show as a very special live guest when you feel the time is right. And from everyone at Teachers Talk Radio, we are right behind you and we wish you all the very best. So I'm delighted to be joined on today's Teachers Talk Radio by Gawain Little, the NEU National Executive Member, who is standing to become the NEU's next Deputy General Secretary, and Michelle Codrington-Rogers, the first Black National President of the NASUWT, who was appointed last year and served for 1 year. They'll be taking my questions and they'll be taking your questions too. So do put your questions on the chat or call in and make your voice heard and get an immediate response. In fact, Gawain is calling in right now, so I'm going to connect him in. Good afternoon, Gawain. Can you hear me?
I can. Yes, Tom. Can you hear me?
I can hear you loud and clear as well. How are you?
Very good. Well, thanks. Yeah, tired after 3 days of intense discussion and debate at our conference. But yeah, very well.
Thanks. I'm sure that's great to hear. And I think we've got Michelle on the line as well.
Good morning. Good afternoon. Can you hear me?
Afternoon. I can hear you loud and clear, Michelle. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Sorry, just to point out, it's a 4-year term in NASUWT.
4-year term.
So I'm in my last year now.
You're in your last year. Thank you so much for pointing that out. I did try to look that up, but thank you so much for correcting the record there. So could I just ask you, first of all, to introduce yourselves, your educational backgrounds, your trade union backgrounds, and why ultimately you chose to be a member of your union. If we could start with Michelle, please.
And I'm also going to start by saying hi to Gawain over in Norfolk. We are
hi,
old,
Michelle.
We are old colleagues.
We are.
Indeed.
So my name's Michelle Codrington-Rogers. I'm based in Oxfordshire. That's how I know Gawain. I'm a citizenship teacher and have taught at a large secondary in Oxfordshire for about 15 years now. I'm just going to say as well, I'm passing on my support and solidarity to your friend and your colleague, Matt, as well. It's mm-hmm. always difficult to get that news, and I hope he will gain strength from all the support that he will get from not just your regular listeners but all of the community as well. So yes, I think that's and the reason why I got involved in NASUWT, I came from the National Union of Students, weighed up all the different trade unions, joined all of them like all teachers did, and decided to stay with NASUWT.
Fantastic, and I'm sure Matt will appreciate your very warm words, Michelle. Thank you. And Gawain, if I could ask just the same of you, then just introduce yourself, your educational background, your trade union background, and why you chose. Well, actually, first of all, which because the NEU is, of course, a new merger organisation. So, where did you come from in terms of that as well?
Yes, of course. So, my name's Gawain Little. I'm a primary school teacher in Norfolk, but I previously taught in Oxfordshire, which is how I know Michelle. I used to be the Oxfordshire secretary for the NUT. So when I started teaching, I think probably like many teachers, joined the union that had the majority union presence in the school where I was teaching, which was the NUT. I think the other thing that attracted me was that the NUT always took educational positions as well as trade union positions, and that was quite important for me as an educator. And I've been active in the union ever since I started teaching.
Thanks very much for that. Yes, we'll definitely come on to the issue of sort of educational positions versus trade union representation when we come on towards the end of the show as well. So thank you very much to the two of you. My first question then, especially in the current climate of the COVID pandemic and of increased well-being issues and workload issues for school staff, why is it important then for teachers and school staff to be a member of a trade union, and how can they get more involved? If I could start with Gawain on that one, please.
So I think there are a whole number of reasons it's important to be a member of a trade union, but one of the most important is it is the most effective way of having your voice heard as educators. We know that in far too many of our schools, colleges and other settings, they're kind of battered about by policy passed on from government with very little consultation, very little discussion with the profession. But coming together in a trade union, bringing together educators from all different settings, all different walks of life in order to raise their voices together, means that we can really be heard. And I think we've seen this throughout the pandemic. It's only due to the work of the unions that we were able to make workplaces safer, but also that, you know, that we've been able to push back on some of the more ridiculous suggestions we've had from government about how we should be educating our students in a pandemic.
Yeah, thank you for that. If I could just Press you on one small thing before I move on to Michelle. You talked a lot about sort of representing members in the pandemic times. Could you just tell us a little bit more about how the NEU used, for example, Section 44 during the Christmas period to help put pressure on the government?
So for us, it's been really, really important that our response to the pandemic has been driven by the expertise of our members, and that we've gone out to our members. So every action we've taken has been based on members acting in their workplace. Yes, with national guidance and national support from the union, but really empowering people to make a difference in the workplace. We've actually gained 3,500 new workplace reps during the pandemic, I think due to that approach. But in January, we were faced with a really, really difficult situation. The government was convinced that all schools would reopen right at the beginning of January. They had some measures for secondary to be slightly delayed and some measures for some areas in London, mainly, where rates were high. But apart from that, the rest of the country was due to be fully open. And yet on the 31st of December, they published the guidance that Sage, their own advisors, had given them, which said that it would be impossible to control COVID rates across the country if that happened. So we had to take fairly decisive action. We advised our members that we didn't believe it was safe for them to enter the workplace because of that risk set out by the government's own scientists who were saying it wasn't safe. So we offered that advice, and we offered members the means to enact it by letting their school, college, other setting know that they were not available to work from the workplace, but would be available to work from home. And of course, within 24 hours, the government had U-turned, decided it was unsafe for students to be in, for schools to be fully open, and moved over to the position that we put in the first place. I just think it's a shame they didn't listen to begin with. It meant our students went in some settings, in some schools on that first day, and contributed to spreading the virus. Maybe if the government had listened rather than had to be pushed, there would have been less deaths.
Thanks very much for that. Just a reminder to our listeners as well, those of you who are listening live on Podbean, if you want to share your ideas about why it's important for teachers and school staff to be a member of a trade union, or if you are a member of the NEU or the NASUWT, then you can share, of course, your views on Podbean. You can text in with your views, or you can call in with your views. And of course, there will be a prize at the end of the show for the best caller who will win a very special Teachers Talk Radio mug. Michelle, same question. Question to you then. Why is it important for teachers and school staff to be a member of a trade union, and how can they get more involved?
So for me, it very much starts off with collectivism, and it has to be about knowing that you are supported, not just by your colleagues in your faculty, if you're secondary, for example, or your year group, but actually it's being part of something a lot bigger. And I believe fundamentally in the power of trade unions. I'm from an island where it was the trade unions that helped push for the independence from British Empire. So I know that trade unions, when it comes to collectivism, that's what it should be about. It should be knowing that when you step into your classroom, you're not stepping in alone, that you're stepping in knowing that you've got the support and the legal knowledge and backing, not just of your colleagues, but of the whole union, the whole trade union, but also the whole trade union movement as well.
Thank you very much for that. And we'll definitely come on to talk about collectivism versus individualism when we talk about the rise in non-union legal cover as well, towards the end of the show. Just to share a few comments I've had in on Twitter. Jim Attridge at The Attridge, who is a local secretary of the NASUWT in Bournemouth, says, "I am confident that unions do their best to represent their members. However, the biggest difficulty I find is that people are reluctant to attend school union meetings, let alone local branch ones. So it's difficult to know what people want. That's from a local NASUWT secretary, Michelle. So could you just respond to that? How can you encourage more union members in schools to attend local meetings?
And I think Gawain has kind of touched on this, actually, is that it almost feels like suddenly people have understood what trade unions can do and what they do, due to the kind of the scariness of being in a global pandemic. I'm a citizenship teacher, so I teach about trade unions, and I hope that my students, when they go into whichever workplace they end up in, they will join a trade union. But for a number of our members, as teachers, all we want to do is teach. We want to be able to walk into the classroom, deliver our lesson, leave at the end of the day, take our marking home if we need to, and just be able to be treated as professionals. And for a number of our members, under what's happened over the last year or 14 months, they've suddenly realised that actually trade unions are there to protect your rights so that you're able to do all of that without having to worry that you're suddenly going to see extra pressures, extra and extra extras being put onto you as a result of your job. And teachers don't see themselves as employees. So I think when it comes to how do we get our members out, it's clear you focus on what it is that our members are concerned about and what information they need. And sometimes our members won't hear it until they need to hear it. And so, you know, during a global pandemic, when people are being told this is what education is and this is what our expectations are of teachers, this is when a number of our members go, actually, I remember seeing that email from my school rep or being able to get in touch with my local association secretary. Now I'm going to get in touch with them. But I think it's very much about building that sense of your support network in a school, in a local association. And it takes time, but it also means that kind of continuing to keep hammering those messages home.
Yeah, thank you for that. Yeah, no, very interesting. Thank you. And certainly if you are a trade union member listening to the show and you've got ideas about how you can get local members more involved, then please do call in or text in. Gawain, I don't know if you wanted to add anything on that.
I would. I mean, I'd agree with what Michelle said. I think it's all about the relevance of it. So we do a lot of surveying, of talking to members online using digital tools and things to get a feel for what the issues are that they really want issues on. So it's that relevance. But then there's also the sense that you can change things. So I think that sense of agency, that sense of collective power, you're not attending a union meeting because the union meeting needs you to be there and to go through the minutes of the last meeting or some other, those kind of stereotypes you get in trade unions. Mm-hmm. Trade union meetings should be about discussing what the issues that affect us, how can we make a difference on them? And then when you see real results, you see the value of coming together collectively, whether that's at the workplace level, the local level, regionally or nationally.
Thank you. So yes, we've got two elements there. We sort of got the relevance and we've got the collective nature as well, which is very interesting. Thank you. Okay, so we're going to get into something a little bit more, I don't know, meaty perhaps. We're going to talk about exams because both unions discussed and debated motions on exams and actually came up with slightly different responses to that. So if we start with the NASUWT, there is a motion which was about replacing GCSE and A-level exams with teacher-based assessment systems. And 57% of delegates actually voted against this motion, saying that it could lead to greater workload and teacher bullying by parents. The proposer of the motion, Candida Mella, said that exams discriminate against certain groups of students. Female students have been proven to do better with more modular or coursework-based testing, and students with special educational needs will find sitting and concentrating for long periods of time a hugely difficult task. And she added that the temporary cancellation of exams this year, along with the use of teacher assessments, may be a start to the reassessment of exam systems and a consideration of how better to use teachers' expertise. National Treasurer Russ Walters replied, "We need to be careful what we ask for. Do we really want an examination system managed wholly by teachers? Do we really want to add massively to a workload of our already overburdened members?" So, Michelle, I want to hear from you. What do you think? And from conversations we've sort of with people in the union who you're friendly with, what do you think should happen to exams?
So let's start at the beginning. I think we're pretty much all in agreement that our exam system isn't perfect. And the way that we assess our children and young people doesn't match the needs and the strengths of all of our students, right? And I'm talking as somebody who loved doing coursework at school, hated doing exams, always crumbled before an exam, because that pressure, that expectation on a couple of hours sat in an exam hall didn't work for me. I did it, but it didn't work for me. And so the discussion, and I'm really glad we had a debate about this at our annual conference, because actually what came out of it was we have to be careful what we wish for. And it really goes back to the core of kind of, again, picking up on something that Gawain said earlier in relation to people thinking about what education is, especially in the context that we've been in for the last 14 months, because we have to think about what education is. And the reason why we had such a rich debate was because people saying we've got to be careful what we wish for, because we already hear the government talking about teacher assessed grades. And let's be honest, those of us in education who are responsible for these grades realize we can predict a grade. We can say this is a grade based on all the evidence, but at the end of the day, the ultimate decision is the school. It's the head teacher or the centre who sign off on those grades. So I might predict for, and we always say little Johnny, and I hate that phrase, but I might predict a 9 for a student. But once it goes through the system, even within the school, that grade can change. Then the exam board themselves or the moderators or whoever the government give the powers to, they can then make that decision. So when we hear the government talking about teacher assessed grades, we've got to push back on this, because although it may be so-called teachers assessed grades, it's hanging our members out essentially as the kind of cannon fodder, because we will then get all the pressure from the parents, we will get all the pressure from the press as well, why didn't we get it right, and the government are then able to hide behind us and say, well, it was teacher assessed grade, so it's up to the teachers. Now we've got to make sure as a trade union and as educationists that we are protecting the profession and the professionalism of our members. And I think from my perspective, we need to be pushing back on this phrase teacher assessed grade, because that's setting up our profession to take the fall for the fact that the government, despite months ago saying that they were going to cancel exams, haven't got a system in place that actually we know could be tried and tested. And so when we talk about an alternative, we need to be talking to the pedagogists. We need to be actually thinking about how we review and rebuild the exam system so that it works for our students and for where they want to go next.
Thank you. If I could just pass that on to Gawain as well. So the NEU had a more unequivocal position on this, voted to replace GCSEs and A-levels with more flexible means of assessment. As far as I'm aware, the original motion, which actually called for the abolition of GCSEs, was amended to back the replacement of GCSEs and A-levels with wider-ranging, more flexible curricula, specifications and means of assessment, which engage with the needs of students in the 21st century. And delegates also voted to abolish SATs and baseline tests in primary schools, based on the fact that statutory primary tests have not taken place for 2 years. So my question to you, Gawain, is what exactly would these alternatives to GCSEs and A-levels look like?
Right. So I think, as Michelle said, I think there's actually much agreement here, in spite of the fact that, as you say, we've taken a slightly more unequivocal position, that we know that the current exam system fails our students at every level. We know that it doesn't work, but we also know what the government's put in place this year is just completely inadequate. As Michelle said, they've developed no support for this alternative system, and yet they're going to put it all at the door of teachers and say, well, you decided these grades, without having any system for doing so, without having any support, without having proper moderation systems put in place. So I think there are huge, huge problems with what's been done this year. And of course, we called on them back in September to set up a process, a year-long process, for teachers to be able to assess their students. And at the time, they were saying the exams will definitely go ahead. We don't need to put this in place. The exams won't be cancelled. We don't need to invest in teacher assessment. Well, once again, they've been proved wrong. In terms of where we should go, I'll start with primary as a primary school teacher. I think myself, my colleagues in primary, we all know that the current range of high stakes primary tests serve absolutely no purpose. I don't know a single secondary school teacher who puts any stock by the SATs results that children come up with from year six. They reassess them again because they know those results are not reliable. The same goes for Key Stage 1 SATs, for the baseline test, for the multiplication check, for the phonics check. You know, there's a statutory assessment, a high stakes, high pressure statutory assessment in almost every year of primary school now. It's an absurd way to treat our children, and it generates meaningless data that everyone ignores because they know it's not robust. So there, I think we just need to put our foot down and scrap them. We know parents don't want them. We know teachers don't want them. The only people who seem to is the government. So let's get rid of them. I think GCSE and A level, there's a bigger discussion there, isn't there? Because these are, you know, GCSE was a school leaving exam. There are a lot of voices now right across the political spectrum saying there needs to be some kind of review, because actually our students stay on past GCSE. It's no longer the school leaving exam that it was. And then, of course, A-levels have progressively moved from having an element of coursework basis to being more and more single exam focused, which, as Michelle said, just doesn't work for some students, and it doesn't give everyone a fair chance. So I don't want to set out a blueprint now. I want to say what we need is a high-level commission into this, where we bring together pedagogical experts, we bring together those from universities and others who these students will be going to when they leave compulsory education, to say, what kind of assessments, what kind of standards do we need in the future? And let's develop a new system together that takes into account everyone's views, but most importantly, again, as Michelle said, that serves the students we teach. It should be about what enables them to progress to the next stage of learning. And just the final point I'll make, even Ofsted themselves say that this is a problem. There was a report way back in 2012 into maths teaching in our schools from Ofsted called Made to Measure, where they said that far too often teaching focuses on bite-sized disparate pieces of learning which don't provide a solid foundation for the next stage of education or employment. And the reason for that is it's all jumping through hoops for exams, and you know that's not what employers are looking for. It's not what universities are looking for. We need a proper assessment system.
And sorry, I'm just going to jump back in there, because with my trade union hat on as well, we can't let the government continue to just be influenced by so-called business when it comes to what our education system needs to look like. And so we have to also be able to put our foot down and to say, well, actually, yes, we know that business needs X, Y, and Z, but actually business needs to step up and make sure that they're putting the training in place for their work, for their workforce, rather than pushing it down into schools to say that we want people to be able to do X, Y, and Z to help our business. We have to think about what education is for and what it's about. And again, picking up on what Gawain said, we want people who can think and make decisions and to engage with our wider society, rather than just be trained, I guess, for either the factory floor or the office or home office. Now, actually, if businesses want that level of expertise, then they need to put their hands in their pockets and invest in that, rather than expect schools to do it.
100%. It's educating the future generations of citizens, of whole-rounded people. That's what education should be about.
Thank you for that. Very interesting. Some very valid points there, I think, and certainly I agree with the point that actually this requires a lot of sort of discussion and think and, you know, high level thinking about this rather than rushing into anything. I'm going to point out that Daisy Christodoulou, who is an author and director of education at No More Marking, I think No More Marking is a sentiment we can all get behind, has also blogged on the point that actually teacher assessment has a huge problem with bias. So Harlan 2004 suggests there is bias in teacher assessment relating to student characteristics, including behavior, gender, and send, and overall academic achievement and verbal ability may influence judgment when assessing specific skills. Burgess and Greaves 2009 showed that teacher assessment might be severely detrimental to the recorded achievements of children from poor families and for children from some ethnic minorities. And Christodoulou also points out that in exams, everyone is treated the same. They take the same questions in the same conditions at the same time, and it's hard or even impossible to get special treatment. Exams are also usually blind marked. So in that sense, surely exams are the fairest and best opportunity for students from disadvantaged backgrounds. Michelle, if I could start with you on that one, please.
Well, even... I'm going to possibly disagree here and cause some controversy.
Feel free to disagree.
Even an exam.
Sempre aparece um filho de Deus.
Aí o motorista, ô Ger, tá na hora de descer.
That wasn't me.
No, I know.
I was going to say,
carry on. That was
the controversy. That was it. I've said it. No, I mean, when it comes to exams and actually how exams are, how they're sat, the questions, the values that they put on those questions, there's bias right there. We know that. And it kind of links into decolonizing the curriculum, because actually the way that questions are set, the way that students process and interpret information and how they express themselves, there is inherent bias in the exam system as well. And so we have, this is why I say, you know, we have to think about what is education and what do we value within education and how we assess it. And I think I'd be stupid to sit here and say there's no bias in when it comes to the grading, because we do have bias, and whether it's conscious or unconscious bias, it is going to influence in how we interact with individual students, how we assess and how we engage with those students as well. And what we've got to focus on is what do we do to mitigate, and in most cases to minimalize and remove that bias. But to kind of pretend that the exam system and that idea of sitting in an exam room for 2-3 hours is bias neutral, I think that is a problem in itself.
Gawain, I'm going to move on. I'm so sorry, because I've just had a look at the top. Go on, 30 seconds.
So children living in poverty are around half as likely to get 5 good GCSEs as those not. You cannot say the exam system is unbiased. It's hideously biased. Mm-hmm. The question really, and we know that there's bias in teacher assessment too, which we have to iron out through moderation. You have to have robust moderation processes which hide student identities when we're moderating. You also have to look at what the outcomes are for different groups, break it down so you can see where those biases are. But the choice we have is you can either put people through an exam where the bias still exists, but pretend that it's completely objective because it's a written exam, or you can take on the question of bias in education properly, and you can take on the question of outcomes for different groups properly and challenge it for a proper moderation process. And that's what I'd favour.
Thank you, Gawain, for that. Yeah, no, very useful and very informative. Thank you. I'm going to stick on the issue of bias in education and outcomes as well, because we're going to move on to an even more controversial subject than exams, which is going to be exclusions. So my question is, what, if anything, would you like to see change about the role of exclusions in schools? Now, Gawain, I'm just going to say, if I get anything wrong on this, because, you know, I've been looking at the media over the last few days and it's actually all been very confusing for me. I think Dr. Mary Bowstead made a speech yesterday and attempted to clarify a few things. So if I do get any, if you do think I get anything wrong here, please do feel free to correct. But as part of a wider motion 21 on protecting Black lives in education, the NEU conference highlighted the concerns of the Runnymede Trust, a race equality think tank, over the rising number of exclusions, particularly involving Black schoolboys. And I've seen a lot of reporting, mainly self-reporting on Twitter, about how sort of the NEU has been influenced by the No More Exclusions group on this, as far as I'm aware. The moratorium, which was voted on, was proposed by the Runnymede Trust rather than by No More Exclusions, and the NEU didn't propose or vote on any particular affiliation with No More Exclusions. Now, conference voted in favour of, as part of this, campaigning for a fully inclusive, properly funded education service where education is reduced, ultimately ended, and a moratorium on exclusions in the wake of a pandemic, as part of that wider motion on protecting Black lives in education. Now, we'll come on to what Dr. Mary Bowstead said as well, but exclusions is really buried deep within this motion, right? The wider motion is Black lives in education. So, I mean, you've got experience of trade union conferences. Is this an example of a poor composite, or is it a strong stance against exclusions?
So I think it is a stance around what we need to do on exclusion. I do think it's been misrepresented in the media, but this isn't a composite. It actually came from our Black Educators Conference. So it was put forward by our Black members, and it does call for a reduction for exclusions. As you said, exclusions to be reduced and ultimately ended as part of a fully inclusive, properly funded education service. Now, I actually work with permanently excluded children. That's my current role. I work in alternative provision with children who've been excluded. And it is very, very clear to me, as someone who educates those children, that many of those children who come to us who have been excluded would have been able to have stayed in mainstream education if the proper support was provided. Now, quite often, schools aren't able to do that because of a lack of funding. So whilst on the one hand, the government constantly says it wants to improve and develop behaviour in schools, they're cutting all the services that would enable that to take place. So most local authorities no longer have a behaviour support team because they were all made redundant due to government funding cuts. Most schools no longer have behaviour support or inclusion teachers as their dedicated role because the funding for this was cut by government. We're increasingly seeing support staff roles who support many of these students being cut because the funding's been cut by government. So what happens is you take money out of the system so they can't cope with and support students to improve and manage behaviour. And then, of course, there's no recourse but to exclude those students, and they end up excluded when it would not have been necessary. So that's the point about an inclusive and properly funded education service and the need to reduce exclusion. But on the
is it an EU policy now to ultimately end exclusions?
I mean, I would think that everyone would want to ultimately end exclusions, because what we want to do is end the behaviour in our schools that leads to exclusion. You want to support people in order to manage their behaviour and not reach that point. Now, that's not to say, and Mary was very clear on this in her speech yesterday, that's not to say that if there was a serious violent assault, if there was a sexual assault in a school, of course, exclusion has to be the process for dealing with that in the situation where we are at the moment. But surely we'd all like to move to a position where we don't need to exclude students, because what we're doing is investing and improving behaviour in our schools. And as to why it's in this motion around Black Lives in Education, I just think the statistics on exclusion are shocking. If you are a black boy, you are five times more likely to be excluded from education than any other student. If you are a Roma student from a Roma family, you are 9 times more likely to be excluded. But, and this is the one that shocked me most of all, if you're a black boy with special educational needs on free school meals, so if you have that combination of race, special educational needs, and poverty, you are 156 times more likely to be excluded from education. Now, this cannot be right. It cannot be right. Surely we should be supporting all of our students, putting the funding in to have high standards of behaviour in all of our schools, supported properly by behaviour support teams, specialist staff, etc., rather than simply excluding children, passing the problem on. And let's be honest, you know, the number of children who are excluded from education who then end up in prison is absolutely shocking. Surely we should be aiming to change that path.
Do you think that's a correlation, or do you think it's causation or correlation then that students who are excluded are more likely to end up in prison? Do you think it's a direct consequence of being excluded, or do you think it's sort of symptomatic of wider factors?
I think it will be a combination of the two. Of course, it will be. There'll be a number of linked factors that can lead to exclusion, that can also lead. But the impact of exclusion on a child, I mean, it cannot be underestimated. As I say, I work with children who've been permanently excluded, and when you see the impact that both the behavior that has taken place, but then the fact that the response to that is exclusion rather than support to change, manage that behavior, that is often a trigger that then makes things far, far worse in that child's career, in terms of their behavior, in terms of their in terms of their ability to get back on track. So, you know, we need to be investing to stop exclusion, not simply to allow poor behaviour in our schools, but to stop it because we're addressing the behaviour rather than just passing it on.
Now, as I sort of said, the reaction to sort of the motion which was passed on Twitter was rather volatile, and there are a number of people who actually DM'd me on Twitter, who replied to me on Twitter saying, for example, whether or not this is entirely true is another matter, the NEU platform, No More Exclusions, was so horrifying to me I quit on the spot. And also Mr. G at Resor One Teaching DM'd me on Twitter saying, I don't think exclusions should be used lightly, but they certainly shouldn't be taken off the table because there are a range of reasons why one may be appropriate, especially considering other parties that may have been affected by particular behaviour. And I think that last point in particular was clarified by Mary Bousted in her speech, when she said Let's have a look. We also believe that you do not intend that girls who have been sexually harassed in schools and colleges would be required to remain in a classroom or walk down a corridor with a perpetrator of that harassment. The NEU's own report, It's Just Everywhere, showed how routine is the harassment of girls in schools and colleges. In those cases, and in cases where teachers and support staff are physically attacked whilst doing their job, we believe that the sanction of exclusion must still be available, if that is the correct sanction, to keep the victims safe and to keep boys who are viciously bullied or attacked safe. Now, Michelle, I haven't heard from you, unfortunately. We've just been stuck on that with the NEU. So I just wanted to ask you about the NASUWT's position on this. So the NASUWT passed a motion stating that pupils who make malicious allegations against teachers should face appropriate disciplinary action, including permanent exclusion. And so that's implicit then support for exclusions. What, if anything, would you like to see change about the role of exclusions within the school system, Michelle?
Sorry, I think it's very right that Gawain was given that time to discuss the policy of NEU, so that, please don't apologise for that. I mean, at the end of the day, exclusions are one strategy. They're one of what schools can do to ensure that our schools are a safe place for our students, a safe place for our colleagues, but also a place where our students are able to get the best education. And the education in a setting that suits them. And so I think our policy in relation to malicious allegations are that actually our schools are also a workplace, right? And so they need to make sure that they are a place where we can do what we need to do to focus on the education of children and young people without worrying that if we tell a child off, for example, that they're not going to come with. And remember, we're really clear about malicious allegations. Mm-hmm. So, we have to remember that it is about that maliciousness, that attack on a member of the school community who's trying to do their job.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And if I could just go back to Gawain, because there was something interesting, and there's an echo going on here. I'm not entirely sure why. On Wednesday, the 17th of March, the new Children's Commissioner, Dame Rachel De Silva, has announced that she wanted to end exclusions in English schools. De Silva also expressed her desire to launch the largest consultation with children ever undertaken in England, including on off-rolling and alternative provision. Now, when De Silva announced that she wanted to end exclusions in English schools, I don't think she received quite the same level of vitriol as the NEU did. Gawain, do you have any idea why that might be, that the NEU got considerably more criticism than the Children's Commissioner?
I'll be totally honest. There's a bit of a narrative here, isn't there, set up by some who would like to paint educators, whether that is educators who are members of the NEU or educators who are members of the NASUWT or anywhere else, to mm-hmm. paint us as the bad guy in the story. When we worked to keep workplaces safe during COVID, we were told we were closing down children's education, even though our members were still going in, even though they were supporting online remote learning for students whilst teaching vulnerable and key worker children at the same time. It's a bit of a shame. And I think, if I'm honest, the government has a lot of responsibility for this. They've set up an oppositional system where anything we say, they like to stir that we're somehow causing some kind of problem. And at the root of it, a lack of respect for educators from our politicians. And I think that's a real, real shame. We should be able to all sit down together and to work to do what's right. And yes, that does involve ending exclusions. It involves getting us to the point where actually we're able to support and manage behaviour in our workplace. It doesn't mean that there won't ever be a case, as Mary said, where that's the appropriate sanction. But surely what we want is the very best behaviour in all of our schools and colleges, our children doing as well as possible, and the investment to do that. This government doesn't want to invest. They've been very clear about that. They want to withhold money from our children's education. And maybe demonising us is part of the process of doing that. I just think it's a shame that they don't respect educators.
Thank you for that. We'll definitely come on to issues around funding as well, and in terms of pay and priorities for school finances. My next question then is about what steps schools should be taking to decolonize the curriculum. Now, Michelle, you talked about this at NASUWT conference. You said that Black history should be fully embedded in the curriculum in UK schools and taught across all subjects, and that every subject has a responsibility to change the narrative that Black people only have a history of enslavement and colonization. I'm a history teacher, so I've been at the forefront. I've been listening very intently and being involved with these questions about decolonizing the curriculum. Just for the benefit of our listeners, some of whom might be new to Teachers Talk Radio, where we've discussed issues around decolonizing the curriculum before, can you just explain the difference between a diverse curriculum and a decolonized curriculum, because these terms have been thrown around interchangeably?
No, thank you. And what I'm going to start by saying, it's really about the idea of increasing visibility of the Black communities, and I use the word Black as in the political sense. So I think it's really important that people understand that. So when we talk about the term Black, it was a term that was embraced in the 1980s, which brought together communities of from the Asian communities, from the African communities, from the East Asian communities, from the Arabic communities. It's that diverse group, those diverse groups that the government tried to put us under the term BAME, which doesn't work. It isn't a real term. So we use the term Black in the political sense. Mm-hmm. And so for us, it's about making sure there's that visibility. Now, I'm apologizing here in a way to the history teachers who have had an absolute battering over the summer, because it wasn't just about history. And I actually wrote an article to say I wasn't calling for Black history in the curriculum. I'm calling for Black visibility across the whole curriculum. I'm a citizenship teacher. And so it's important that we recognize that there's been Black contributions to Britain, not just in history. So not up until the point when citizenship takes over in the Second World War, if that makes sense, but actually today. So we've got Black visibility we need to make sure that our children and young people and our community see themselves reflected in design technology, in modern foreign languages, in citizenship, in art, in all the subjects, in sciences, so that it's not just being confined to history. And so I hope that the history teachers out there understand exactly what I'm trying to say.
Yeah,
as somebody who did A-level history and loves history, I am, you know, by nature a historian. So what we're talking for is that, and you've asked for steps, and the steps are quite simple, I honestly think, because as schools, we're used to revising and reviewing our curriculums. Every time the government puts its political aura into what we should be teaching in schools, schools basically pull their sleeves up, and we think, what do we need to do to make sure that we're changing our curriculum? So it's about reviewing what we teach now, assess it, think about where's the visibility, where is the recognition of contributions of Black communities to what we are teaching in our subjects. So even if it's music, do we talk about Bangla? Do we talk about traditional Chinese music? Do we talk about soca and calypso? Because this is what our children's experiences are. How do we engage with our communities and with our students to think about what do they want to see in their curriculum? We then try it out. We trial lessons. That's what teachers are good at. We are trying out and finding out what works and what doesn't work. And then we review it. We reflect it. We think about how we can improve on it. And then we go through the system again. So we already do it for all of our subjects. So I'm not sure why. I know that in the press over the last week or so, I know I got a battering about what I was trying to do in a kind of erase so-called white British history. Actually, no, it's about what we do in schools all the time. And as a PSHE teacher, we are constantly being told by the government what we need to be including in schools as a result of what's happening in wider society. What we're asking for is for that to happen in relation to the whole curriculum, to make sure that all our children and young people see themselves reflected.
Thank you. You know, definitely, you know, as well as teaching history, I teach 3 hours a week of music as well to year sevens. And we talk about Chinese music. We talk about samba and the origins of samba. We certainly talk, you know, I don't teach year eight music, but we talk about sort of historical origins of blues as well. But I think but definitely more can be done. And I think I personally think teachers need more planning time in order to actually think about how we can actually go about that. Now, I've noticed Callum Weverell's called in, has come into the live studio. Callum, if you do want to call in with your headphones, you've got the opportunity to win a Teachers Talk Radio mug. So please do call in. And of course, anybody else in the studio who's listening in, please do call in because you have the opportunity to win a Teachers Talk Radio mug. So the motion which was passed by the NASUWT was that conference believes that curriculum frameworks across the UK should reflect, respect and value the contributions of all communities that have contributed to building the UK. Conference further believes that Black history is a part of British history and thus should be fully embedded and taught across the curriculum. Conference asserts that education should equip all children and young people to understand and respect their own and each other's histories, cultures and traditions, and promote critical thinking. Michelle, if I can start with you then. So decolonising the curriculum, does this need to be teacher-led or government-led or both? And can a curriculum be fully or mostly decolonised without government support?
Well, the government had an opportunity to respond and they did twice. And their argument is schools have already got the freedoms and flexibilities to teach what they want to teach, essentially. And they've been very hands off about it. Now, it's interesting when the government want to implement policies such as, I don't know, teaching British values in the UK. All of a sudden, they're suddenly very hands on and demanding that it's being taught in schools. But when schools are asking for guidance, support, funding so that they can build that time in, and so that there is also a confidence building. Let's be honest that a number of our colleagues like you are doing bits already, but there are also a wide number of our colleagues who want to do it but don't necessarily feel they've got the confidence to, and are really worried about making a misstep or offending somebody or causing you know, and so they want the confidence, they want the CPD, they want the training, but all of a sudden the government is saying, well, schools can already do it. So at the end of the day, schools are going to do what they need to do and what they want to do, because schools will basically pick up where the government have got no political will. But the pressure does need to come from the government as well, because we want, what ideally the government should be doing is creating a space again where pedagogists can work together across the education sector. So that's primary, secondary, that's tertiary as well. Get the university academics involved, and so that we are talking about what our curriculum should look like, because at the moment what our children and young people are being taught is such a rose-tinted version of empire. And we have got colleagues out there who are resetting the balance. Even when I was at school, I'm really proud of the fact that my history teacher taught us about what was happening in Ireland, taught us about the history of what was happening in Scotland, and taught us about what happened in India and the Caribbean, and didn't just centre on slavery and Britain kind of going overseas and the white saviour complex, but actually talked to us about how people fought back, how there was agency, how the civilizations existed before the Europeans got there. And our colleagues need that confidence to be able to do that, but also need to be given the tools and the resources. So when we talk about the government, we're also talking about, going back to what we were talking earlier, about exam systems, because if the exam system values certain things, then schools will focus on that. But that's where we need the government influence to be able to say to the exam board and Ofqual, for example, to say, actually, let's think about what you're valuing here so that we can make sure that we are assessing what we need our students to be learning. And so Wales announced that they're going to be embedded Black history in their lessons. And our argument is that's a brilliant step. Let's see what that looks like, because maybe England can learn, England and Scotland and Northern Ireland can learn something from that as well.
Thank you. I should also just say, to before I bring in Gawain, and also I've got an echo again, so please just to check your headphones. If anybody wants to catch up on Teachers Talk Radio in terms of discussions around both decolonising the curriculum and also increasing the opportunities and talking about the sort of educational experiences of Black teachers as well, I would really want, you should be catching up on Emily Folarancho's shows, which are on a Monday evening. She's on Twitter at Miss Folarancho, and she hosts the Late Show, and she's had a wonderful variety of guests. many of whom are Black, who talk about their own experiences attempting to decolonize the curriculum, the struggles they've faced, and some of the successes they've had as well. Now, before I move on to Gawain with a question about that, I just want to unmute and then welcome Callum Weverill. I interviewed Callum, goodness me, how many weeks ago? It must be 3 weeks ago now.
3 or 4 weeks, yeah.
Three weeks ago, and we talked about exclusions, which we did mention with Gawain and with Michelle as well. Callum, if you could just introduce yourself to those of you who didn't listen 3 weeks ago and just talk about your educational background but also your trade union background as well.
Thanks for having me on, Tom. So quickly going through it, so I currently work in mainstream education, specifically in a resource provision for children with autism, but prior to that I've spent most of my 12-year career working in special education, often working with those pupils that have been excluded or experienced exclusion in the past or very close, and ended up in special schools for that reason. So that's kind of where my interest and, understanding of exclusion comes from. And then in terms of trade unionism, as Gawain, I am a member of the National Education Union, been at conference this week, have been actively involved in the union for the last 10 years, attended the last 5 years of conference. Not currently a rep in school, actually, but I am supporting our current rep.
Thank you, Callum. I'm going to come on to you, if that's okay, in a short while about a question about teachers' pay, if that's okay. And I'm going to go to Gawain now, because the NEU passed Motion 8 at their conference, which called for a broad and balanced curriculum offering opportunities for creativity, exploration, and for meaningful collaborative learning. And the NEU has also called on the Department for Education to draw up a strategy to make the profession more representative and more open to promotion for Black staff. Now, given that the NEU has said the government needs to leave the classroom when it comes to curriculum, do you think efforts to decolonise the curriculum would be more successful if teacher-led or government-led, if you're calling for the government to leave the classroom when it comes to curriculum?
So I think educators have to have a key role in that, and that's all educators, teachers, but support staff too, in that kind of grassroots movement to develop curriculum. And we've seen that right across the country. We have a whole number of areas where people are trialling new approaches to decolonize curriculum, anti-racist curriculums, etc. But while the government still has so much influence in our classrooms through setting out curriculum expectations, etc., as Michelle has said, if the government doesn't do anything to support those approaches, but it's supporting other approaches, effectively, it's putting a block on that progress. So, I mean, I think developing that decolonized curriculum has to be part of a whole school approach. It's not just about taking different subjects or bite-sized bits or even just about curriculum reform. It has to be part of a whole school anti-racist approach. And as a union, we developed the NEU Anti-Racist Charter, which provides a framework for schools to explore both questions of curriculum, but also to empower Black staff and students to explore and express what matters to them, to support young people's right to speak out and engage as active citizens with issues around racism, to challenge racial inequalities and oppressive racial norms, so that you're changing the curriculum, but you're also making explicit discussion of racism and empowerment to take positions against that part of what we do as a school, because it's part of that whole rounded education for all of our students, isn't it? This is, we can't fall into the trap of thinking, a decolonized curriculum is just to support and empower our Black students. All of our students need to know the whole of history, not just this small little section that's presented, but also the whole of music, the whole of maths, the whole of art. You know, why do we not learn about Black mathematicians, Black scientists, Black? It has to go right across the curriculum. And there are, I'm a primary maths specialist, and there are some fantastic books for teaching maths that take into account diverse global perspectives, etc. I've got one in front of me now, If the World Were a Village, which is wonderful for primary school maths because it explores the idea of percentages. Essentially, you imagine that the whole world was a village of 100 people. How many of them would speak English? How many of them would live in different countries? How many of them? And it breaks it all down. So it's a great way of exploring maths, but at the same time, you're looking at that global content rather than taking a very Eurocentric or just British perspective on it. So I think it's important that we take that whole school perspective. And I'd really recommend people check out, just Google NEU Anti-Racism Charter. Mm-hmm. It's a fantastic tool for setting up that discussion in your school. But yes, government's got to be involved, given how much undue influence they already have over our curriculum.
Mm, thank you, Gwen. I've just had a look at the time. It's 1:59. Now, I'm happy to carry on past two if you're both still available to carry on, because we've got no show after us until 8 o'clock. So if you're happy to carry on going, then I'm more than happy to keep you on, unless you've got somewhere to be or go.
I can do a few more minutes, that's fine.
Fantastic.
Yeah, I could probably do a few more as well.
That's fine. Good, because I'm going to talk about the NEU and pay now. And I'm going to start with Callum on this one. My question is, what should unions prioritise when it comes to teacher pay? Should it be this 7% pay rise that the NEU has called for? Should it be about reforming or ending performance-related pay? Ensuring that COVID doesn't get in the way of pay progression? Safeguarding teachers' pensions or something else? So just to give a little bit of background to this, now last year Rishi Sunak, the Chancellor, announced that school staff earning over £24,000 a year would not receive a pay rise in 2021, and that's all teachers except for unqualified teachers. The NEU then voted to call for a 7% pay rise and build towards a ballot for national strike action if its demands are not met. And it also called for teachers' pay to be restored to real terms 2010 levels within 3 years, an end to performance-related pay, and the annual publication of data by establishment on pay and pay progression, including equality characteristics of teachers denied pay progression. 99% of delegates were in favour. Now, I'm going to come on to what people have been tweeting about in a moment, but just to start off with, I'm going to ask Callum first and then go to Gawain. By calling for a 7% pay rise, has the NEU failed to read the room here?
So to begin with, I kind of come at it from a different angle in the fact that I'm a member of support staff. So again, that's, you know, it's the lowest paid education workers of all primarily. Directly in response to your question, yes, being very aware of the current climate and the amount of people who have lost their jobs, you know, suffering severe financial hardship. But at the same time, you know, Kevin and Mary made a very good point in their speech on Friday about for workers across the whole spectrum. You know, we've had people clapping on a Thursday evening. We've had, you know, people saying, yes, teachers have done great, support staff have done great, doctors, thank you for saving us. But actually then everybody gets a real-term pay cut. And yeah, 7%, whether that's specific, you know, I haven't really looked into too much detail around the specifics of 7%, but actually, you know, the false praise that's been going on and all, but then actually giving people a real-term pay cut in terms of it, and obviously that's been going on year, it's just an insult, really.
Mm. Now, I certainly agree on your point about sort of warm words and then not quite matched up with actions. I'm sure Gawain can clear up some of the detail. 7% pay rise. Is that really what teachers should be thinking about at the moment? 7%?
Yeah, do you know what? I'm honest. I do think it is. I mean, our public sector workers, essential workers in the private sector too, have risked their lives during this pandemic. And we had plenty of warm words from government, and then the threat of a pay cut, not just for teachers, a pay cut for nurses, a pay cut across the public sector. I think it's absolutely shocking. And the government has attempted to do this by trying to pit public sector workers against private sector and essentially say to us, well, you're lucky you've got a job and other people aren't getting a pay rise. The fact is it will impact on everyone, because we know that if you cut pay across the public sector, which is what the government's proposing on doing, that impacts on the job market. And it means that private sector pay will be cut as well, because private sector employers negotiate pay with their workers on the basis of, you know, where else could they go and where else could they? If there's a pay cut in the public sector, it will drag down private sector pay too. What happens then? Everyone's being paid less across the board. And what's the impact of that? It takes money out of our economy. People don't have that money to spend. And before long, what happens is you get further job cuts. So if we want to lead into a spiral of austerity, job cuts, unemployment and homelessness, then yeah, cut public sector pay. But do you know what? If the government did the opposite, if coming out of this terrible crisis, the government did what governments did after the terrible crisis of the Second World War, when we came out of that war and we rebuilt our economy by investing in a welfare state, investing in public services, and we had our economy booming again. If they invested properly, like other governments have done following crises like this, what you would see is investment in the public sector leading to rising wages in the private sector, leading to increases in jobs and our economy back on track. The government has to make that choice. And do you know what? I make no apology for being really clear what I think we should be doing. We should have investment in our economy so that everybody can get back on their feet after this crisis, not cutting pay across the board and forcing people to lose jobs. So yeah, we should be campaigning on it. But how do you do it? And I think part of how you mobilize the strength for that, now this is internally within our union, but across other unions too, I think partly how you mobilize that national campaign on pay is by tackling pay inequality at a local level. We know that it's hard to win those ballots. We know that it's hard to get people to come out and put pressure on the government for the pay increase they deserve. But we also know that there's terrible pay inequality. In the primary sector in particular, we have many, many members of primary staff who have leadership responsibilities they're not paid for, who haven't made pay progression during coronavirus or before, most of them women. Held back. The gender pay gap now runs into the thousands. If you're in leadership, it is even higher. We need to be taking that on. We need to be saying where women aren't making progression, but their male colleagues are, where their male colleagues are being paid for leadership roles, but women taking on those same leadership roles aren't, we're going to challenge that. We're going to fight on that. Where people, any member is being refused pay progression after the work we've put in this year, we're going to challenge that. And I think by building those fights to get a fair and equitable pay system, you build up the strength and the power to take on this battle with government to say, invest in our economy, no return to austerity. Let's rebuild our country after this terrible crisis.
Thanks very much. You've got a lot of praise in the comments here, Gawain. You've got Callum, of course, who said very well articulated, Gawain. And you've got Dave Cunningham, who is our technical expert on Teachers Talk Radio, who says, Gawain, such a strong point, so clear and well made. I'm going to read out some comments and I'm going to go to Michelle on the question about pay inequalities, certainly in Academy Trusts. Mr. G at Resort One Teaching DM'd me on Thursday to say, whilst a 7% pay rise would be lovely, I don't think it's a good reading of a room in the current circumstances, especially when you consider the 1% rise for nurses, and it only helps create more negative headlines around teachers. At Mr. J side tweeted, of all the things I can think of teachers wanting from their job, more pay would genuinely struggle to get into the top five. It really isn't about pay. Alex Richardson at 1917 and all that tweeted, the way workers get decent pay and conditions is by fighting for them. Having a weekend was pie in the sky once. At HTH Ferland tweeted, 7% pay rise is never going to happen unless you want teachers to be seen as the Antichrist and cripple school budgets as it won't be fully funded. This only leads to cuts. At KC Sunshine 73 tweeted, not sure we are threatening anything. I guess fair pay while we are preparing exam classes for the extra weeks of work and extra assessments we will be setting and marking wouldn't go amiss, rather than exam boards still being paid for no marking. And Hannah McCaffrey at HannahBull76 tweeted, when people are finding themselves unemployed as a result of the current situation, I would not be expecting a 7% increase in my wage. I would also not be supporting strike action on this basis. I want to be in the classroom with students and the economy to pick back up. And John Matthews at skeptical_John tweeted, while the Conservative manifesto had a larger pay rise than that for early career teachers, we're talking about the 7% pay rise. In terms of the NASUWT then, Dr. Patrick Roach, General Secretary, said, like other key workers, teachers were applauded on the doorstep but have been treated with contempt by government, insisting that teachers' efforts were not worthy of a pay award. And this comes on quite nicely into the issue of pay in Academy Trusts for CEOs. So the Times Educational Supplement reported last month that there are now at least 7 state school leaders who are earning salaries of £250,000 or more. The NASUWT backed a campaign for more scrutiny of Academy Trust finances, including the excessive salaries of senior staff, and called for all Academy Trust leaders' salaries to be put on the public record. So my question to you, Michelle, are MAT CEOs paid too much? And if AR, what would you like to see happen to the excess in their salaries?
Thank you. I know our new president, Phil Kemp, has been absolutely unequivocal in his and on behalf of our members, which I strongly support, the fact that multi-academy trusts need more regulation. How can you call yourself an executive head when you're not being paid, especially on the pay scales? But kind of picking up on that point in relation to teachers' pay, I was really fortunate my role when I was president to make the case with our delegation to the School Teachers Review Board and the Independent Welsh Pay Review Board, and the arguments around needing to decouple teachers' pay from performance management, because we have to talk about the impact, not just, and I'm glad Gawain, he said a lot of what I would have said, so I'm just sitting here cheering. Mm-hmm. But there's also the race pay gap as well, and then we have got that huge gap between those who are teachers and support staff. Now obviously NSUWT is a teachers union, so I can't speak on behalf of support staff, so I'll leave mm-hmm. that for Gawain. But you know, when we talk about who's actually in the classroom delivering, and then we see this huge chasm between that and our so-called multi-academy trust leaders, who, if you're lucky, you'll see once a year, if they, you know, if there's that. And we have got to have this regulation. We have to know where that money is being spent, how it's being spent, and how it is driving forward the education of children and young people. Because when you have schools then, especially in this context, then are pleading poverty, but we also know that the money's being used at the multi-academy trust level, and they're not putting their hands in their pockets when schools are saying we can't afford and we have to start restructuring and making redundancies. I'm sorry, but the multi-academy trust then has to look and put their hands in their pocket and go, well, what can we do financially to make sure that money comes back into the schools to make sure that they have got the resources that they need, which also includes the professionals in the classroom to support the children and young people. But one thing I did want to pick up on is this whole thing about the public versus the private is such a fake argument. And I'm going to really hammer this home, because if, and I, as I said, I can only speak for teachers, if teachers find that their pay is stagnated again for another 10 years like it was prior, then the only negative impact is on the community, because teachers are taxpayers. We pay taxes, but we also are consumers. So if we have more income that matches the inflation, at least, then it means that when our bills go up, that we are also able to buy from the independent coffee shop. We're able to go and support our local farm producers. We're able to go to our local markets. We are able to put back into the economy. So it is such a false argument that it's private versus public, because actually we are consumers as well. And we do contribute to our communities. And I know both unions have put out survey responses of actually how, despite pay freezes, pay cuts, and teachers and school staff are still putting their hands in their pockets to support our children who come to school in need. So whether that is making sure that we have got extra lunch, whether we've got coats, whether we've bought pens and pencils, all of these things out of our own pockets, when the school budget is being pressured, guess who are the ones who are holding it together with spit, blue tack and sellotape? It's us in the schools. And so there's a false economy around school budgets as well, because there are so many of us who are subsidizing the school budget, as well as not being able to kind of be able to say, well, actually, my income reflects my professionalism.
Mm. No, thank you. Some really strong points there. I just want to say, before I move on to the final question, congratulations to Callum, who has won himself a Teachers Talk Radio mug, for calling into the show today. So please, could you go on to the contact section of our website, which is ttradio.org, and fill out the contact form, including a postal address, just to say that you've won the Teachers Talk Radio mug on the Saturday News Hour and a bit. You can just call it the Saturday News Hour with Tom Hopkinsburg. So thank you for calling in and congratulations. And I look forward to seeing you pose with that mug on social media. My last question then, bit of a controversial one. I've seen on social media over the last 48 hours, the ADAPT, it's not a union, it's legal cover and support for teachers, talking about a huge rise in membership and having got its most members in one day so far during the NEU conference. What does the emergence then of non-union support services for school staff, such as ADAPT, suggest about perhaps shifting teachers' attitudes towards the more traditional unions like the NEU, like the NASUWT? It's an interesting question. I should say before I pass it over to Gawain first, we did ask ADAPT if somebody was available to come on the show. There wasn't anybody available. Gawain, what does the emergence of these non-union support services suggest about shifting teachers' attitudes towards the more traditional unions?
So I think we need to be clear about ADAPT. It was launched almost 10 years ago, I think, with support from government as an alternative to trade unionism in education, provide legal support without giving you any kind of a voice. And they've pushed them, you know, they've pushed them quite hard again as part of this narrative to try and undermine teacher unions, but it just didn't take off. And you have to ask yourself why. Well, ADAPT themselves, when they were launched, commissioned some research into what educators wanted from a professional association or a union. And it kind of backfired because their own research found that over 80% of educators wanted a collective voice on issues like pay, working conditions, and educational issues. And of course, that's something that they don't provide. So I'll be really frank and I'll be really blunt. A trade union is about educators, an education union is about educators coming together to raise their voices and speak together. If you're one of those educators who'd rather sit down, shut up, and be pushed around by government and just do what you're told, then by all means join one of these organizations. But if you're a professional, you've got opinions, you've got views, and you think the government should be listening to them, then join the trade union.
There's an interesting question raised here then about individual legal representation versus collective bargaining. But more and more teachers are considering either leaving the union, although of course you're getting an influx of new members as well.
I just want to jump on one thing there, because I think maybe I should have made this clearer. I don't know what their biggest recruitment day in their history is like, but frankly it can't be that large. The population of educators has remained roughly stable throughout this crisis, and yet we have a net increase of 35,000 more members than we had a year ago. The actual gain has been much more than that, because obviously some people retire, come to the end of their career, leave the profession, etc. But the net gain, we have 35,000 more members than we had 1 year ago. So frankly, the idea that there's an increase in people either leaving education unions or joining some other kind of organization which provides legal support but effectively won't give them a voice, I think it's a bit of propaganda from an organization that wants your money. I don't think it really bears up to scrutiny. And like I said, I think people are joining us because we've had an impact. They know that by joining the NEU, by joining an education union, what they can do is they can raise their voices, they can be heard, and people have to listen to them. And frankly, people should be listening to educators. There should be much more respect from politicians, from government, for educators. And that's what we'll do as a union. We bring people together to change things.
No, thank you for that. So Callum Weverell says, it would appear the vast majority of educators don't understand what a union is. Our former president Amanda Martin describes it as the family you can choose to be in, which is a very interesting point. Michelle, I want to ask you about something a little bit more specific here, which is that we reported on Teachers Talk Radio on Friday the 19th of March that the Conservative MP Brendan Clark-Smith's bill allowing teachers to seek broader representation in legal hearings has passed its first hurdle in the House of Commons. Now, Section 10 of the Employment Relations Act 1999 says employees are entitled to be accompanied to a disciplinary or grievance meetings only by a workplace colleague or a trade union representative. Now, ADAPT on this says that its representatives are usually welcome into grievance and disciplinary meetings, but and it's very rare that they are turned away because of what that would message about was sent about the school and their leaders. But even so, the MP for Bassett, Lord Brendan Clark-Smith, has proposed that teachers and education staff can choose a person other than a trade union worker or a colleague to attend a disciplinary or grievance meeting with them. What impact would that have on unions like the NAS, UWT, if that were to be passed through Parliament?
I'm going to be absolutely honest and say I haven't followed that. I'm sorry. I've been quite quite preoccupied with teaching my lessons and making sure that our members' voices are heard. But we have to remember that when we talk about organisations like EDAPT, and I'm going to, all I can do is add to what Gawain has said, they fundamentally don't understand what the role of a trade union is. And so our members, and I absolutely agree, our membership has as well increased despite our profession already being quite, numbers being quite static. But when we talk about representation, even I'm still an activist, I'm still based locally, and I can tell you that when our members are invited, and I use the word invited, to to attend a meeting, I can guarantee you probably 99.9% of the time, that's when they get in touch with the union and say they want somebody who is qualified, who understands and is trained in the understanding of not just employment law, which is where we have issues with sometimes lawyers trying to market their services to teachers, but actually they want people who are expert in teachers' contract, in the school teachers' pay and conditions, and most importantly in the Burgundy Book. And when we are talking about how a trade union prepares its reps to represent its members, that's where, I'm sorry, but organisations like EDAPT, who I know in the past their members have got in touch, and they haven't had anybody available in their area at that time to go and support their members or their subscribers or whatever they're called. Actually, it's then when our members are getting into, people are getting in touch with us and saying, how do I join a union? What can the union do? What advice can the union give me? And so actually, when we talk about what a trade union is, I started off by saying it's about collectivism, because our members need to know that actually the union is there with them every day in their workplace. And if they're not with them in the workplace, they are definitely active and visible there in the local community, because when you need that help and support and you've got the expertise, that's where the trade union is able to give that support to its membership, because we are more than insurance and we are more than just legal advice. We give that ability to not just collectively bargain nationally, but also that collective bargaining in a local level and in school, at school level. And there have been a number of times where myself and Gawain in the past walked into a meeting together and we negotiated on the best, for the best outcome for our members, and it had an impact on the, not just the school but also in the wider community. And that's what a trade union is. It's about that collectivism. And we're not just there as an emergency service like an ambulance. We are there for the long haul, and we'll be there for the long haul, because it's about us doing what's best for our membership and in the knock-on effect for the whole profession.
Thank you for that, Michelle. I should just say, because of our Teachers Talk Radio mission statement, which is that we do seek to promote as many varied views as possible while sticking to the Equality Act, I should point out that EDAPT doesn't market itself as a trade union. So it probably does understand what a trade union is, but offers itself as a union alternative, talking about how it's apolitical, we don't get they don't get involved in industrial action. I should probably just make that point very clear. But thank you so much for those responses, which brings us up to the end of the show, only about 22 and a half minutes late. So thank you to our excellent guests, Gawain Little and Michelle Codrington Rogers, for their contributions to this afternoon's news hour and a half. Thank you to, of course, Callum Weverill, who's called in and won himself a Teachers Talk Radio mug. That could be you next week. Don't forget to call in if you're listening on Catch Up, on Spotify, on Apple Music, on Podbean. If you listen live 1 till 2 p.m. every Saturday, you have that opportunity to call in and win yourself a Teachers Talk Radio mug. You can catch up on all things Teachers Talk Radio on our website, ttradio.org. If you feel like you can do a better job hosting than me, then you can email teacherstalkradio@gmail.com, or you can DM us on Twitter at ttradio2021 to get involved in hosting. We've got four shows on a Saturday and four shows on a Sunday, and we've got shows every single weekday, both some on some days we've got the morning break, on other shows we've got the drive home, 4 till half 5, we've got the late show, 8 till half 9, and we've got the late show, 10 till half 11, and we've got shows 7 days a week. If you want to be a guest on a future News Hour, then follow and DM me on Twitter at HB_history. That is it for today. Thank you so much for joining us, and don't forget to tune into the late show at 8 p.m. tonight with Kelly Rouse, and see you on the next News Hour next Saturday. Thank you, Gwen, and thank you, Michelle, and thank you, Callum.
Thank you so much.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.